I know that I summarized chapters 17 to 27, or the Holiness Code is kind of, it's named, last week, but I want to start this week again by re-summarizing it in another way that hopefully will help us be understanding and less confused about some of the things that you'll notice in these two chapters today, 19 to 20, that are, to us, kind of just logistically a little confusing. And I'm not even really talking about the content as much as just like the arrangement of the chapters themselves. So I want to talk about just the arrangement of the book, this last basically half of the book. Because if you look and even just glance at 19 and 20, you'll notice that 19 discusses a lot of different topics, and honestly, it just kind of seems like a shotgun approach. It's like, let's just throw all these random topics here for a whole chapter. And it's like, okay, like we're not going to dwell on any of those. And then chapter 20, if you just glance through it, you're like, wait a minute, doesn't this sound like 18? Only this time it actually lists punishments. Whereas in 18, it was just like, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. And now in 20, it's like, don't do this, and if you do, this is what happens. So it's like, why this repeat? And then why in 19 is like just this very random list here. So again, I'm not even like really talking on the level of like specific content, mostly just like the arrangement book itself. So to figure out what's going on, I want to step back again and look at chapters 17 to 27 or the Holiness Code in another way. These chapters, again, 17 through 27, the whole rest of the book, these chapters open with warnings against idolatry and sexual immorality, which we talked about last week in 17 to 18. And then they are followed by essentially that kind of random collection that we see there in 19 is essentially a mini Torah or a mini law. And then in 19, that's where that mini law is. And then punishments for idolatry and sexual immorality are seen in chapter 20. These first four chapters, I would argue, should be read together as the opening and the summary of the rest of the book. And it probably honestly would have helped if I had done this last week to talk about all four of them together, but there was honestly just way too much material in the first two chapters for me to justify that at all, because I would have just gypped the last two chapters completely. So what I want to do this week is pause and kind of reorient going on in these chapters. The remaining chapters after these first four then provide more details and instructions mostly addressed to the priests for living out these things that are summarized in these opening chapters. This is, after all, the book of Leviticus, which is primarily concerning the Levites or the priests. So it makes sense that after this kind of summary section, these opening four chapters, you have kind of practical implications of all the things that were just summarized, played out through the priests' eyes, mostly, of like things that they're in charge of or things that they need to do that are particularly important to them as the priestly class. Practical examples and appropriate punishments and kind of longer versions of especially the things seen in 19 are seen if you go back to Exodus, especially chapters 20 to 23. So there, again, 19 is a much shorter version of what's seen back in Exodus and what's said again later in Deuteronomy. But here in Leviticus, chapters 21 to 22 give instructions and criterion for priests regarding how they mourn, who they can marry, and also laws about blemishes, uncleanness, and acceptable offerings. And then 23 to 24 cover mostly feasts, special days, and sanctuary rules officiated by the priests. 25 and 27 cover the Sabbath year, the year of Jubilee, and the funding of the temple, again, mostly concerning the priests. And then I would argue, kind of like I said last week, that 26 is honestly really the conclusion as far as like the content of the material that's in it. So again, when we get there, we'll talk about 26, 27 reverse order. But in 21 to 27, then, we largely read about how the priests themselves are to follow and or officiate some of the practical outplayings of the commands given in these opening four chapters. So as we finish these first four chapters by looking at the last two today, let's look at them together first as a group so that we can better understand what 19 and 20 are doing. In these four chapters, we find a literary device that, I know there's a fancy word for it, but it essentially works like a sandwich. You have, at the beginning, you have idolatry and immorality. And then in the middle, you have a mini law. And then at the end, you again have idolatry and immorality. So basically, if you think about it, the bread is the idolatry and immorality, and then in the middle, depending on your sandwich preference, whatever you want to put in the middle there, is the... So that's your sandwich. That's what's happening in these chapters. This summary of the law, focusing in on 19, is essentially a brief retelling of the Ten Commandments and the entirety of the laws that were given to the people as they prepared to enter into covenant with God as seen in Exodus 20 to 23. So now, why is that important here? Well, in Leviticus, we literally just had the priesthood class ordained, and God's presence came into the camp. So back then, you had the covenant started, and now you have God's presence in the camp, finally. So now it's like a brief redo of that, like, hey, remember that thing that you entered? Well, now he's here, so let's do that. And then in Deuteronomy, you're going to have a covenant renewed as the people actually enter into the promised land after a 40-year delay. But much of the wording in this chapter, chapter 19, can be traced back to Exodus and is seen again in Deuteronomy, like I just said, when the covenant is renewed. This chapter then is a mini law that is representative of the whole and is therefore not intended to be exhaustive. This is why to us it feels a little random, because it's basically, like, it feels like a shotgun approach, and it's honestly because it is. It's really just kind of like boom, 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 summary representation of. It's like a see Exodus 21 to 23, or 20 to 23 is essentially what this chapter is saying. So that's like the middle of this section. And then let's look at kind of the again, following the metaphor earlier, the pieces of the bread, the idolatry and the sexual immorality. Why are idolatry and sexual immorality singled out as important enough to begin and end this summary of the law? And why are they essentially the only topics discussed in the punishments covered in chapter 20? Because if you actually look through Leviticus, you'll notice that chapter 20 is really the only chapter that you just have explicitly like punishment, 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 punishment. Like Leviticus is kind of known as the book of punishments, among other things. But there's really a concentration that happens in 20, and you see them throughout. But it's like, okay, why in this chapter that's really like the punishment chapter? Why is it just idolatry and immorality that are singled out? The answer to this question was seen at the end of chapter 18 and is seen again at the end of chapter 20. And if you wanted to look there while I'm talking, it's 18, 24 to 30, and then 20, 22 to 26. At the end of both of these chapters, we read that the obedience of people in these two areas will be the primary factor in their continued possession of the land. The uncleanness of the nations of Canaan in these two areas was the primary reason that God is now driving them out. And the faithfulness of Israel in these two areas will become the primary reason of either their possession or their expulsion from the land. So what makes these two things so important? Idolatry, first, is important because the people have entered into a covenant with God and are now his people. To worship another god demonstrates a violation of the covenant in the highest degree. It is to essentially say that we are no longer your people. God promised his people a land that would be his land, where he would dwell with them. So if they refuse to be his people and instead worship other gods, then he will kick them out of his land and into slavery in the lands of the other gods, which, again, is just like natural consequences. It's chronic, actually. It's like, if you're going to choose to not worship me in my land, but worship other gods that are usually in other lands, well, guess what? I'm going to let you get kicked out to those lands, but the result is going to be that you're going to be slaves in those lands. So by choosing to worship and strive after other gods, oh, you're going to get what you want, but what you're going to want is, or what you're going to get is slavery there. Like, you will end up being impure, unclean, and enslaved by those things that you were desiring that are not me. I mean, we could just camp there all day for application, seriously. Because in our own hearts, anytime we dethrone God and put something else on the throne of our heart, how many times we end up enslaved by that very thing that we're desiring, that we think is more important to us and better to us in that moment than God, and we end up being enslaved to it. That's whole other topic for another sermon, but like, you can dwell on that for a little bit if you want. But anyways, continuing on, that's idolatry. Sexual immorality is important because it not only violates God's intention and created order, but also destroys the very fabric of society, the family. Sexual immorality is singled out alongside idolatry because discussed in even greater length here than in Exodus, because as we discussed last week, it consists especially in that culture of power plays, rivalries, broken homes, and disregard for the welfare or even the life of others. It destroys the nation from within. In this book that primarily concerns the Levites, who are to serve as examples, teachers, and guardians of purity and holiness, idolatry and sexual immorality are emphasized so that the priests may be particularly on guard against these two offenses that are particularly self-destructive to the people. So that is why you have this primary emphasis on these two things, because these two things will ultimately lead to the self-destruction of God's people. Remember, God disinherited the nations back at Babel, and he could have left it at that. But then he chose Abraham and began a people for himself with him. God could have done that anywhere and at any point, or not at all. But he was going to fulfill his promise and his threat that he gave to the serpent in Genesis 3:15, that his, the serpent's, days are numbered. One day, an offspring of Eve bruise or crush the serpent, and God was going to see that happen. Abraham's descendants saw this God powerfully deliver them from Egypt, and he decided to love them and wanted to coexist with them. He didn't have them then follow a bunch of crazy laws for no reason at all. When it came to sexual relationships, he wasn't thinking about how much he could keep them away from having as much pleasure as possible. The point was about stability for the people he had raised up through Abraham and Sarah, and for perpetuating their existence. Yes, the laws are given because God knows what will make us happy. He knows what kind of relationships will foster happiness, good relationships, and good character, and he knows the kind of relationships that will foster misery, brokenness, and strife. We talked about all that last week. Those are legitimate applications of the sexual immorality sections and the idolatry sections. Yet even still, it is conceptually bigger than that. God's laws promoted the stability of this entity called the descendants of Abraham, whom God loved and promised to raise up. He had a destiny in mind. He would multiply them as the stars of heaven, but to do that, Israel needed to be kept alive. And to do that, they could not strive after and pursue idolatry and sexual immorality, two things that were ultimately self-destructive to this entity that God was going to fulfill his promises through. God insisted upon certain laws and upon certain punishments to cut off any sort of degradation or self-destructive process as soon as it began. God's intent was to preserve his through whom he was going to fulfill his promises. So with this big picture in mind, let's dig into 19 to 20. In Leviticus 19, like I said earlier, 19 is essentially a brief retelling of the Ten Commandments and the laws that were given to the people as they prepared to enter covenant with God. It is intended to be representative of what faithfulness to God looks like. Again, remember, like I just said, the whole point of this summary and what God is, the instructions that God is giving to the people and the priests, is for their own good, just like we saw in the Deuteronomy thing that I had read. It's for their own good and for their preservation. It's so that they will remain faithful to him and remain a people, God's people. It is also intended not only to demonstrate faithfulness to God, but also intended to represent God's own character. This is probably the best explanation for the repeated refrain of, "I am the Lord your God," or "I am the Lord," after every grouping. If you look through Leviticus 19, after every paragraph, depending on how your Bible is formatted, but after essentially every paragraph, you're going to see this refrain, "I am the Lord," or "I am the Lord your God." This chapter starts with, "You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy." Because the people are supposed to picture not only loyalty to God, but also his characteristics. This is why I had Deuteronomy 10 read. In it, we see God describing and characterizing himself. If you caught what was happening when Wade was reading those verses, God was saying that he is the only God, the God of gods, the Lord of lords. And then he then characterizes himself as impartial, just, compassionate, generous, and loving. Therefore, his people are to live out these characteristics in their conduct. Deuteronomy 10 also reminds the people that these laws are for their good and their prosperity, and they are ultimately about their heart. That is why you have circumcision language in Deuteronomy 10 that is actually talking about the heart, which is a theme really picked up on later in the New Testament. The people are called to be circumcised of heart to love God, to serve him with all their heart and with all their soul. And then he goes on again to describe his fairness, his justice, compassion, and his love to people. It is little wonder, then, why Christ summarized the law as love God and love others. Because in passages like Deuteronomy 10, 12 to 22, where you see God describing himself, you see him almost infallibly also describing his character, and specifically his character towards people. We cannot say that we love God while living in complete contradiction to the things of him. This is why, getting back to our text today, each paragraph ends with, "I am the Lord your God," or the shorter version, "I am the Lord." Essentially, each paragraph ends by saying, "I am God. Be loyal to me and be like me. Be characterized by what I am characterized by." And that's why you have, as you look through 19, you have things like compassion and mercy and even like transactions and stuff like that, and how you are fair and just in those, followed by "I am the Lord." Be characterized by justice, by fairness, by compassion, by mercy, be love, because I am your God. And those are the things that characterize me. So therefore, you are also to live out those characteristics as my people, picturing me, the world around you. Because if you don't, then you aren't picturing who I am. After this summary command, then, of "be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy," the first specific command we read is, "Every one of you shall revere his father and mother." Actually, I read that backwards, and I kind of did that on purpose. It says, actually, if you look, "Every one of you shall revere his mother and father." What is interesting about this command is that this is actually in reverse order of what we'd expect. And if you're like not even thinking as you say it or read it, you do what I do, is you just say it in reverse order, because that's what we're used to hearing and used to seeing in the Bible. This is probably two things probably going on here. This is possibly an allusion back to Genesis 9 and Ham's sin against his mother, just as we talked about last week. And this would probably kind of be a mirroring then of what we saw back in 18, where the first sexual sin prohibition was against uncovering the nakedness of your mother. And so here you have the mother first referred to. So it could possibly be an allusion back to Genesis 9 again. But I would also argue that or probably only, because again, like the allusion back to Genesis 9, is like how much do they continue at that through Leviticus? I would argue that it's there more than we think. But if nothing else, there is also this other one that would probably be good to understand, that this verse is actually meant to be read in conjunction with the Ten Commandment, "Honor your father and mother," back at Exodus 20. Because in Exodus, it's "honor your father and mother." And here, when we're re-summarizing the law, it flips, and it's "honor your mother and your father." By putting the father first in one and the mother first in the other, God is allowing no room for saying that honoring one is more important than the other, or for using the excuse saying, "Well, I honored my father, but you know, I didn't honor my mother, but she's second on the list." So, like, God doesn't make any room for that. He flips them the second time to say that, no, you honor both. You honor both your mother and your father. This, by the way, is one of the many examples of ways in which we see God honoring women, as opposed to the stereotyped view of God as sexist that many people argue for, especially from this book. Including this first command, by the way, about honoring parents, the first three commands that are given can be summarized as, honor your parents, honor God by keeping his Sabbaths, and don't make idols. It is notable how often honoring parents or others is paired with honoring God. And what's especially notable in this context is that these two have an added third one that says, don't make idols. Why are those three all paired together as kind of a summary of everything that's going to come? Notice, for instance, that the groups of commands in this chapter, largely dealing with treatment of others, are followed by the refrain, "I am the Lord." Also notice that honoring the handicapped in verse 14 is equated with fearing God. How you treat others is equated with your view and your honoring of God. to honor people made in his image. Remember, he said, don't make idols, because people are made in his image. And one way of speaking, people are the God-ordained idol that he has chosen to represent himself. That's why we aren't to make idols, because he's already made an image of himself. We are made in the image of God. Honoring people, then, is to honor God. We, then, who believe that all people are made in the image of God, have no excuse for dishonoring, name-calling, belittling, or intentionally harming or defrauding others, no matter how different they are, no matter how much we disagree with them. We are to love and honor others as fellow image bearers, even as we disagree with them or confront them. A great example of this is seen in the life of Jesus as he interacts with the Pharisees. Even in his anger at them for their wrong teaching and their hardness of heart, he grieved for them and longed for them to see the truth. He is not just name calling. He's not just throwing mud. He is not name calling. He's sin calling. He is calling out their sin while grieving for their soul. That is how we are also to interact with those that we may disagree with. There is no room for belittling or name calling or making fun. So even as we disagree with people, we ought to follow in the example of Jesus as we honor them, even as we disagree with them. We also see this in Christ's honoring of others and his treatment of the poor and needy. There was no one that he considered him. He came to love and to serve the broken and the needy. He who could have at any time had a legion of angels, he who could have had any need that he wanted supplied, to serve and to wash feet and to go out of his way to help those in need. So how we view, how we honor others, how we love others shows our honor and our love for God. Again, it is not an accident that Jesus in his two great commandments said we are to love the Lord our God with all our heart and our soul and our mind, and we are to love others as ourselves. As far as the rest of the chapter goes, there are many things that I could dig into, but since this is a representative list of commands given elsewhere, I will save most of that for sermons in which we look at those other texts at a later date. This would also, side note, be a great opportunity, if you have a question, write it down, come to me later, or save it for the Q&A. Just going to throw that out there. There's a ton of stuff I'm not going to cover in this chapter. I'm kind of sticking at the conceptual level or new material level. For today, keep in mind, like I said earlier, that this is a representative list meant to remind the people of their call to live out the character of God and be loyal to him. This is why, as you read through the commands, you will notice that they are brief, and they really honestly, because they are intended to, they give an overall impression of a call to worship God alone, how he wants us to, and to be characterized by compassion, honesty, kindness, justice, love, and forgiveness. You just get this impression as you read for it really quickly that, like, this is the type of person I am supposed to be. And I am supposed to be a God-fearer who worships him alone, the way that he wants. I don't do these other things that the pagans are doing. And as I interact with people, this is the type of person that I am supposed to be. That's the point. Like, as you read through this chapter, you get a picture of what a God-fearer, like, what a person of God looks like. That's the point of this chapter. One thing I do want to address, however, because it is not really addressed elsewhere except for later when it is repeated in Deuteronomy, is the teaching on mixtures in verse 19. Now this one, if you look at verse 19, you might look at it and you're like, what? Like, this is so random. Why would he pick this one thing to focus in on? 19 says, you shall keep my statutes. You shall not let your cattle breed with different kinds. You shall not sow your field with two kinds of seed, nor shall you wear a garment of cloth made of two kinds of material. This is the verse I want to focus in on. One of the reasons, honestly, is that last one there, don't wear a garment made of two types of material, is one of those, like, random verses that people just pluck out of the Bible to say how ridiculous God is. Or, like, well, why do you do this from the law and not follow this from the law? Which, I mean, there's a whole bigger discussion there. But what I would argue here, as I do elsewhere, is that the things that are weird in the Bible are only weird to us because we don't understand yet. So we need to do a little bit of digging into what's going on. So that's what I want to do real quickly here. The people are prohibited from mixing different kinds of animals, different kinds of seeds or different materials in their clothing. And again, this verse seems a bit odd to us, but it's because we don't understand it yet. And it also, if you're really paying attention as you read through Leviticus, it might not just seem odd, it might seem almost contradictory at face value. Because if you paid attention when you read the description of what the priests are supposed to wear, given back in Exodus, in chapter 28, I think it is, and then you also, there's like a kind of a brief flyby of it again here in Leviticus as they do the chapters 8 through 10 ordination of the temple, or tabernacle, sorry. But if you're paying attention there, you notice that the high priest has a lot of mixture. Wait, what? Like, you said don't have mixed clothing, but now the high priest does have mixed clothing. And if you go back in Exodus and, like, read really closely, you'll notice that the priests in general also have mixed clothing, or a mixed belt. Sorry, they have mixed material in their belts. And then in Numbers, if you flash forward, you'll notice that the people are to have one blue cord in their tassels, which the blue and the tassel are actually two different materials. So you're like, what is going on here? Is this a contradiction? Like, I thought we weren't supposed to have this mixture. Notice also that the cherubim fashioned into the tabernacle curtains are represented as an animal mixture. And if you don't see that here, you can flash forward to Ezekiel chapter 1. Just read that, especially 5 to 10. You'll notice that there are like four different animals and all sorts of stuff going on in the description of the cherubim, and that's actually what was pictured in the tabernacle. So you have a mixture right there in God's presence. And then also, flashing forward to Revelation, we see that the tree of life pictured in Revelation 22 had 12 different kinds of fruit. So we've now just found a supposed contradiction in the area of clothing, in the area of animals, and also in the area of fruit. The three things that the people were just told not to do. So what's going on? The messaging is easiest to follow by noticing, ironically, where the color blue shows. If you glance through Exodus 28, you will notice that it shows up a lot in the description of the high priest, but only in the belts of the priest. And then in Numbers 4, you'll notice that it is only the Ark of the Covenant that had a blue cloth at its top, covering it when they were traveling. The blue, by the way, if you haven't caught what I'm doing yet, the blue represents where there is a mixture present. So you have mixture, a lot of it in the high priest, a little bit in the priest, and then one strand in each tassel of the people, and then the blue covers the Ark of the Covenant. And looking even more closely at Numbers 15, where you see that the people are to put one blue cord on the tassel of each corner of their garment, in verse 40, we read that this was to remind them that they are holy to the Lord. This worked as a reminder because the high priest also had a blue cord, same exact words, a blue cord that fastened a plate of pure gold engraved with "Holy to the Lord" on his forehead. Have you noticed the theme that's happening yet with where the blue shows up? Mixtures belong to the Lord and represented proximity to sacred space. Therefore, the clothing, or in the case of the Ark of the Covenant, the cover, spoke of proximity to God. Notice it doesn't speak necessarily of the person. It's not like the high priest is this better person, this better class of person. The high priest has the most blue or the most mixture because he has the farthest access to sacred space. Then the regular priests have less blue, less mixture, because they have less access to sacred space. And then the people are only afforded one cord for each tassel because they have the least access to sacred space. And then the Ark of the Covenant, as it's traveling, is the only thing covered in blue because it is the representation of sacred space. It is God's throne inside the Holy of Holies. So the messaging here, again, is that mixtures belong to the divine realm and are only allowed on sacred space. So there is a theological message here of proximity to God and belonging to God that is given in things as simple as material, and what seed you put where, and color. And I find it really cool, getting back to the connection between the people and the high priest, the high priest had a blue cord that fastened a plate that said holy to the Lord. The people would then be reminded by looking at their blue cord in their tassel that they are also holy to the Lord. Not, they didn't have as much access to sacred space, but they were also his holy people. So what I would argue is that the prohibition here against the mixtures is purposely given and seems contradictory to us because there is messaging going on there that we don't really understand until we dig really deeply into what's going on with where the mixtures are and where the colors are. But this message is that you are my sacred people, and I am teaching you about myself and my sacred space. And that as you get closer to me, you are closer to the divine's, which again doesn't say necessarily anything about the person itself, but about where that person has access to. So why he didn't want all these mixtures outside of sacred space is he's saying that violates the messaging here. If you have all these mixtures outside of sacred space, that's sending the wrong message that, like, I am present, or I am present in the same way. And it gets weird for us because we're, again, in the New Testament, so like the divine presence for us is different than it was back then. But God is teaching about himself and where he is to be through pointing everything to the Ark of the Covenant, to the Holy of Holies, to the tabernacle, to the priests, to how he wants to be worshipped. One way of thinking about it is essentially by having the people only have one cord of blue, is essentially saying you, because you don't have nearly as much blue as the priest and the high priest, you need to go to them to remind you how to properly worship, because they're the ones who are guardians and keepers of fullness. So it is putting up a wall between the people seeking their own way of worship and always being channeled back to the proper way of worship. So there's a lot of theological messaging going on here through simply materials and seemingly irrelevant things like that to us. So I just want to key in for a little while on that one. And then one other note, I know verse 28 brings up the whole tattoo question. We'll be addressing that next week. That's all I'll say about that right now. Chapter 20, there isn't really anything new that is addressed. Since this chapter, as we talked about in the introduction, discusses punishments for different forms of idolatry and sexual immorality that were already mentioned earlier, what I want to discuss briefly then in this chapter is the different forms of punishment that are listed and what they mean. Because again, this is like the punishment chapter. One of the most common punishments that we have seen and will see in Leviticus is being cut off from the people. This punishment seems at face value to be straightforward banishment or excommunication, but it becomes a little bit more complicated when you actually like look deeply and closely at the various contexts in which it's used. It seems that the main idea of this punishment is that this is something that God himself will do, but is often done in cooperation with the leaders. And it has a range of practical applications that can range from something as little as, well, seemingly little, like if you're the person, it's obviously a big deal to you, but like it can range from loss of social status or loss of job to all the way to death. Like cut off can have that range of meaning where you're cut off from an office or from an appointment or something like that, or you're cut off from life. Like it's kind of a broad term. One way the Jews later described this punishment was death at the hands of heaven, signifying that how it was enforced was ultimately in God's hands. Throughout the Pentateuch, the phrase cut off is associated with immediate death, premature death, death of descendants, childlessness, being cut off from an office or status, ostracism, banishment, or the idea of eternal separation from God. And if you just think about the words themselves, cut off, it applies in all of those scenarios. You're cut off from something. Chapter 20, 3 to 5, provide a really good example of why this was viewed as something that was ultimately in God's hands. Because if you look at 20, 3 to 5, and I'll just read it real quick here. I myself will set my face against that man and will cut him off from among his people because he has given one of his children to Molech to make my sanctuary unclean and to profane my holy name. And if the people of the land do at all close their eyes to that man when he gives one of his children to Molech and do not punish him and put him to death, then I will set my face against that man and against his clan and will cut them off from their people, him and all who follow whoring after Molech. So this is again an example of how this is ultimately viewed as something God will do, because in these verses he's promising to cut these people off even if the people fail to do what they are supposed to do in the punishment for this person. Another reason that it was viewed to be ultimately in God's hand is that the the things that resulted in this penalty were transgressions largely in worship of God or what belonged to him or how he wanted to be worshiped. And sexual sins are also sometimes grouped into this category because they actually, if you follow the wording here of these previous chapters, there's a connection between sexual sin and actually defiling the land, which is God's land. So that is still a sin directly against God, for which he will ultimately make sure that there is a consequence for. So that's the idea of being cut off. It does have kind of a range of meaning. Less common and more severe is the punishment for being put to death. This one is honestly pretty much as straightforward as it sounds. There are a couple things to note, though. First, Deuteronomy 17 makes clear that this was supposed to be after a trial in which diligent inquiry is made to confirm the transgression first, that no one was to be put to death on the evidence of only one witness. Sometimes you don't get that impression from the Bible because it's like the story is told in a way where like somebody did something and then boom, like they're gone. Now, sometimes what's happening is that they did it in the sight of many people. So like by default, you already have the whole trial process has just happened because everybody just saw them do it. You don't need a trial at that point because you have plenty of witnesses. But if there's any doubt, they were to have a trial. There were to be at least two witnesses that confirmed what was going on, which, side note, flash forward to the New Testament, I would argue that's why we have four Gospels, because it's like a duplication of the amount of witnesses necessary. It's two times two witnesses to the fact that Christ existed and did what he said he did. So anyways, that's kind of cool aside. This punishment was to be dealt out after proper due course. And then second, this punishment was reserved for capital offenses, such as idolatry, blasphemy, murder, functional murder, which is a little bit harder for us to understand because some of it's cultural, but things that created a situation of functional murder in which the person effectively put the other person in a situation in which they were likely to die. And a lot of that comes into like abandonment or disregard of like wives and children and stuff like that, because in that culture, you're essentially putting a death sentence on them because they're not able to support themselves in that culture. So like functional murder is also punished with the death penalty, and then also some sexual sins are also punished with the death penalty. At the end of the chapter, the people are reminded that their obedience in these areas will determine if they are allowed to stay in the land. The chapter ends then with a corporate punishment of being banished or cut off, which, by the way, is another illustration of the range of meaning of cut off. Exile is also an application of cut off. The people are banished or cut off from the land if they disobey. As far as application goes, we know from the rest of the story that the people indeed were later banished or exiled from the land. In fact, even on their way to the land, they chose not to believe in God and had to have a delay of 40 years to even get in the land. So they didn't have a very faithful start, and then they continued to be unfaithful to the point of exile eventually. However, those who had been faithful were able to enter with the next generation. And God's promises continued and were passed on to those who chose to remain faithful despite their failings, because he ultimately was going to be faithful to the promises that he gave. Until a son of David was born to fulfill the promises. In his time, the people were back in the land, but they were under Roman authority. The thing is, it was never actually about the land. Again, one of the reasons I had Deuteronomy 10 read. It was never actually about the land. It was about the loyalty. Joshua and his conquests brought them into the land, but didn't give them rest. The kingdoms of David and Solomon, as great as they were, didn't give the people rest. Hebrews 4:9 says, "There remains a Sabbath rest for the people." And elsewhere, the author of Hebrews reminds us that we are waiting for a heavenly country and a heavenly Jerusalem, a kingdom that cannot be shaken. And he says, "Let us therefore strive to enter that rest." Leviticus gives instructions to the priests for guarding the covenant faithfulness of the people as they traveled to the promised land so that they may possess and remain in possession of the land due to their faithfulness. Hebrews continues this imagery to warn us as New Testament priests to guard our hearts and the hearts of our brothers and sisters in Christ to remain faithful, as we also are those who journey awaiting our home. Hebrews says, "Take care, brothers and sisters, lest there be in any of you an unbelieving heart, leading you to fall away from the living God. But exhort one another every day, as long as it is called today, that none of you may be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. For we have come to share in Christ, if indeed we hold fast to our original confidence, firm to the end." In one of the parables of Jesus, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith? Will he find faith in us? Let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you for this text. I thank you for this call and this charge that you gave the Old Testament priests as they guarded and taught and served as examples and leaders to the people. And I thank you that we are reminded that this call is still the same to us, that we are also to guard our hearts, to teach ourselves and each other to remain faithful to you, to live how you would have us to live in loyalty to you, and to live characterizing and picturing who you are to the world. I thank you that you have this high calling and this pledge in jars of clay. Amen.